Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. President Trump calls off the summit with North Korea.
In the meantime, our very strong sanctions, by far the strongest sanctions ever imposed, and maximum pressure campaign will continue.
Lawmakers are briefed on the president's allegations a spy was planted on his campaign. House Intelligence Committee Democrat Adam Schiff remained unconvinced.
Nothing we heard today has changed our view that there is no evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a spy in the Trump campaign.
Harvey Weinstein turns himself in on rape charges. Onlookers yelled at the movie mogul as he entered a Manhattan police station this morning.
Harvey! Harvey, what took you so long? Harvey! Harvey!
Harvey!
Harvey!
Harvey!
There's nothing like a New York perp walk. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michelle Kaczynski, Major Garrett, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Was it wise for President Trump to pull out of the summit with North Korea? Does this make a nuclear showdown more likely? Do you believe President Trump's Spygate claims? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Michelle Kaczynski, CNN's senior diplomatic correspondent. She covers the State Department. Michelle, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Ray.
Joining us now from Washington is Major Garrett, chief White House correspondent for CBS News. He also hosts the weekly CBS News podcast called The Takeout. Major, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Ray.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Ray, Major, and Michelle.
Michelle Kaczynski, let's start with you. Were there cracks starting to show in the facade long before we got the copy of the president's letter to Kim Jong-un?
Oh, the letter. Yes, there were many cracks. I mean, some of them we could see, others we couldn't see. And North Korea made it very clear about a week ago when they said that they might not even want to speak to South Korea, that they might pull out of the summit entirely, that they didn't like the U.S. definition of denuclearization or giving up everything all at once. So we knew what some of their major beefs were. What we didn't know, of course, was that a U.S. delegation went to Singapore and sat there and waited for the North Korean delegation to show up and were essentially stood up on the date and then ghosted by North Korea, that the U.S. side had been repeatedly trying to get in touch with them. And as the Secretary of State described it yesterday when he was talking to senators on the Hill, they just got a lot of dial tones. They couldn't even get in touch with the people that they had been speaking to for such a long time. So obviously there were some major problems here. And what our sources say is that even though we know that the North Koreans were hugely angered by the Trump administration repeatedly bringing up this Libya model of denuclearization, where Libya, you know, relatively quickly gave up their nuclear weapons, but then years later, I mean, really for other reasons, and you know, because Gaddafi was a dictator, he ended up being deposed and then killed. So, you know, even though we're not comparing apples to apples in these cases, North Korea hates that analogy, but the administration kept bringing it up. However, the biggest problem from what we're hearing is how they would denuclearize. North Korea thinks that it should be phased over time, and every time they make a step towards denuclearization, they get something in return. Whereas the Trump administration has repeatedly said, you know, we want to do this so that they kind of go all in, and only then do they reap the rewards of it. And that's just this impasse from what our sources who speak to North Korea tell us, that they can't really see being bridged anytime soon.
Major Garrett, inside the White House, is this being seen, talked about as any kind of failure? Or is it being spun as the right thing to do. We heard the president this morning still holding out hope that you could salvage even the June 12th date.
Yes, the president is being both theatrical and kind of disarming in his attempt to say, well, we still have a possibility, always falling back on his rhetorical placeholder, his most favorite rhetorical placeholder. We'll see what happens. The White House told us yesterday through a senior official, look, there's just not enough time to have an adequate summit on June 12th. And to Michelle's point, there is something that's worth noting here. There was great a marquee quality to this announcement. Oh, there's going to be a summit and a great theatrical sort of run-up to it. But you didn't have the stagehands, you didn't have the script, you didn't have any agreed-upon acts, and as Michelle pointed out, you couldn't even get a table read with the North Koreans about any of these underlying issues. I know I'm stretching that metaphor to its absolute elastic limit, but it's really true. There was all, and the president, those close to him say he was caught up in the theatrical aspect of this. Worldwide headlines, the possibility of a first ever summit between an American president and the North Korean dictator. Wow, it had so much punch, so much drama.
Yeah, remember how excited did, he was? He ran into the briefing room.
Right, and you didn't have the hard, steadfast preparatory work being done. And until we see any sign from the North Koreans that they're A, willing, and B, capable of carrying out that. And then once those kind of serious person-to-person talks at a much lower level become engaged and you start actually having a hashing out of definitions, terminology, pacing, mechanisms, all these things that strike some, possibly understandably, as dense and hard to follow details, but they're the essence of what a productive summit will or will not be. And we haven't gotten to that stage at all.
Jack Beatty, do you look at this with relief? Better no talks than bad talks?
I don't know how to score that. I just want to emphasize the American responsibility. We've heard a lot about the North Koreans. All that's true. But NBC is reporting today that Secretary of State Pompeo feels that John Bolton pulled the rug out from under him. That, yes, they were having these problems getting the North to respond even on quotidian matters of scheduling. But that was in consequence of the Bolton bombshell of, what, now 2 weeks ago on CBS, bringing up the Libya parallel. And I'm looking now at the Financial Times. They're quoting a source close to the South Korean president saying pretty much the same thing. And, you know, John Bolton was the man to whom the president dictated his alternatively deferential and even abject letter and threatening letter, sort of suitor's angry feeling of rejection, a preemptive rejection to John Bolton. So his role in this, I think, can't be minimized. And the result is we have a summer that looked like it was going to be beginning some sort of dialogue at the highest level with North Korea, where we have a incipient nuclear crisis again. The South Korean government is in they received no advance warning. The BBC reports consternation there, feeling similar in Japan. The president's caprice and his fear of being humiliated by seemed to have got the better of him, and plus John Bolton whispering in his ear.
Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Capitol Hill yesterday reading President Trump's letter to Kim Jong-un calling off the North Korea summit.
The Singapore summit, for the good of both parties, but to the detriment of the world, will not take place. You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used. I felt that a wonderful dialogue was building up between you and me, and ultimately is only that dialogue that matters. Someday, I look very much forward to meeting you.
Earlier in the week, Michelle, Mike Pompeo was rolling out a set of proposals about where to go with Iran now that the United States is pulled out of that agreement. Pretty kinetic first couple of days on the job for the new Secretary of State.
Right. I mean, remember, he repeatedly used the word crush. Like, you know, Iran's not going to go along with these 12 demands that I've laid out. Well, we will crush your economy with our unprecedented sanctions. We'll hunt down your operatives around the world and we will crush them. You'll feel the sting and the pain of this. So, yeah, I mean, he wanted to make clear that, you know, it's time for Iran to come back to the negotiating table. But many looking at this feel, I don't know if this approach is really going to do that. It's true that sanctions over time might have that effect, but at this point, they're going to be weakened because none of the U.S.'s closest allies in Europe are on board with this. In fact, just the opposite. They want to keep the original Iran nuclear deal. So you have that going on, all the questions surrounding that, and now this North Korean summit falling apart, at least temporarily, or maybe it hasn't, or maybe it has. I mean, it's just kind of this whiplash drama that must be, you know, this is what he signed up for. Maybe not all of it, but he's going to have to deal with this now.
Major, we only have about a minute to the break.
Right.
Mike Pompeo and the Iran messaging, that can be read in a couple of different ways, one including that the United States is still open to some subsequent deal. But I don't know, given the unusual way this White House works, I'm not sure whether that to read that seriously or read the mailed glove and the Velvet Fist Act more seriously.
Well, I can say the Europeans don't read it as a positive signal about a potential future deal because they came to the president very specifically in the person of the French President Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and said, Mr. President, stay within the deal. We agree with you. There are other grievances we have about terrorism and other aspects, ballistic missiles, just to name two. We can work on those things. We can work on them better and more effectively together within the deal. The president rejected that. The Europeans are looking for alternatives.
We're talking about the week's top headlines. You can join the conversation. What did you make of Secretary of State Pompeo's strong words for Iran? What does Harvey Weinstein's surrender mean? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Will President Trump get the whole package he wants on immigration? Is there risk of civil war in the GOP, a family fight over immigration, as Democrats stand on the sidelines? Harvey Weinstein has turned himself in. What's next for the Me Too movement? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Michelle Kaczynski, CNN's senior diplomatic correspondent, Major Garrett, chief White House correspondent for CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told NPR yesterday nothing in the classified briefing on the Russia investigation changed his mind.
There are two investigations going on that I think will give us the answers to the questions that you raised, the IG investigation in the Justice Department and the Mueller investigation. I support both of them.
Jack Beatty, there's no end to the novelty surrounding this. First, Mueller's team being pressured to show a little of what they've got to sitting members of Congress. Then that briefing going on in two separate chapters, Republicans in one, Democrats in the other.
Yes, and to further the novelty, the president's lawyer and chief of staff dropped in to make introductory remarks, raising Democratic eyebrows, as they should. The president was quoted by the Associated Press this week as talking about the informant who's at the FBI informant to the campaign who's at the center of all this. And he said to somebody, one of his colleagues, "I want to rebrand that as a spy." And so Spygate was born, which Adam Schiff, I think, more correctly calls Liegate. There was no spy in the Trump campaign. The FBI was essentially looking after whether Russia was trying to intervene in our election. They were spying on Russia, on anybody. And the president, of course, further lied by quoting a former director of intelligence, Clapper, as essentially agreeing with him, "You know, you put a spy." And Clapper said, "No, I didn't say, I may have used the word spy. That's not what I meant. I didn't mean they were spying on your campaign. They were spying, if the word's to be used at all, on the Russians." The president's resort to this is among the most desperate efforts he's made thus far to assault the foundations of not just the Mueller investigation, but of his own law enforcement agency.
Our first stop this hour, Appleton, Wisconsin. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I think Trump is being underestimated in his ability to manipulate the media. I mean, the Spygate is a perfect example. His comment to Leslie Stahl, that he talks about fake news on purpose to undermine the media, and I think people underestimate him, and I think it's very dangerous. He's very smart. He became president of the United States, and he should not be underestimated because it's very scary.
Major Garrett, how about that? I mean, are we watching in real time in Spygate an example of the president really pulling the strings on how the public understands a story like this?
Pulling the strings in a certain respect and conflating things that sound true but aren't. And Jack well enunciated the problems on a fact basis with what the president said. But the president does this all the time. Those of us who spend every single working day at the White House experience this. I experienced this through 16 months of covering the Trump campaign. There is an art of conflation. There's an art of the deal. That's a book. Art of conflation is the president's way of taking a terminology, introducing it into the media bloodstream, primarily through social media, but also through what he says and does, then hearing the echo effect of him saying it, then saying, "Lots of people agree with me. Lots of people believe that. Therefore, it's true." I've watched this pattern repeat itself over and over and over. And so by the branding mechanism of Spygate, the president said on the South Lawn earlier this week, "You're calling it Spygate." No one had called it Spygate except him. Okay? But then he hears it back repeated through, "Well, the president said it. So, oh, everyone's saying it. Therefore, it's true." This is the pattern within his own mind, and he believes, and there, to the caller's point, there's reason to understand and appreciate, and I don't mean appreciate like applaud for it, I mean appreciate it as a scientific experiment, that this happens.
Michelle, you must run into this all the time.
It works. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we've all lost track of the long list of how many stories weren't really stories because they weren't based in any fact. They're just stories that the president puts out there, or he'll find a piece of bad reporting on the internet, something not based in fact. Fox News is basically his amplifier. He'll find something on there. He'll misinterpret it, or something won't be quite right. But bam.
Don't you still have to run it down? Don't you end up having to respond, follow up on?
That's what I'm saying.
It's part of the process, Ray. It's part of the process.
He turns it into that. It wouldn't normally be any story except in whatever niche he's found it in. But then he repeats it, or he turns it into whatever his own interpretation of it is. And then, bam, it becomes a story because the rest of the press has to debunk it and tell people, here's why this is not true, or let's explain it. But then it's a big story on front pages and in headlines. So even though what he may be saying may have no basis in fact, it's out there and it's repeated, and people then interpret that as they may, not always correctly.
Ray, I will tell you this, my experience from the campaign. I often talk to Trump supporters, and they would say, "Look, you're obsessing about these small facts or things that the president or the candidate at the time said that weren't factual. I'm more interested in the larger truth he's speaking to me about either the swamp or changing everything, or all of our leaders have been indifferent on these underlying economic. The larger truths are what matter to me. This is what Trump supporters would say. And I'm willing to bet right now, Ray, that there are plenty of Trump supporters who are saying to themselves in one venue or another, remember months and months ago he said they were wiretapping him? Well, he wasn't right about that, but there was a spy. He was on to something. There was a larger truth, and he found a way to ferret it out. That's my guy, and he might not have been right about the specifics, but he was right about something else that was going on. I'm quite confident that many Trump supporters are having conversations with themselves along those lines. To them, the fact pattern is almost irrelevant. What matters to them is that, is that President Trump or candidate Trump was on to something, and he got it to the surface, whatever it is that slightly or even just microscopically reinforces the original allegation.
Charlotte, North Carolina is next. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind, Jacob?
This is just, it's sort of, I ran sort of a big example recently, but I've noticed in the Trump administration a bit of a trend of Donald Trump being very open to negotiation, to seeing what the other side wants to do, and then he sort of snaps and he'll break a deal or he'll call something off. And then he'll come out with a list of demands or requirements that he's never mentioned before, catching everyone off guard. And then he'll say that the other side is to blame for these demands or these complications. Like we saw it earlier this year. We saw it very much with the Iran deal, and we've seen it several other times during the administration. So I just wanted to see if your guests wanted to comment on that.
Guests?
Well, sure. On immigration is a classic example of that. Now, the administration did make some concessions when it was still willing to try to find a compromise on deferred adjudication for childhood arrivals, DACA, offering a path to citizenship for everyone who might qualify. They've since pulled that off the table. But now their demands keep ratcheting up, demands that were never part of the original conversations. And not only Democrats find them unacceptable, many Republicans find them unacceptable. And the president's demand internally within his cabinet to foist these politically unsaleable demands on Congress is putting his current Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristen Nielsen, in the middle of the president's rage because nothing's happening. She can't, doesn't have the clout to say back to the president, these are unreasonable, politically untenable demands. I can't make them work. You desiring them is only half the equation. President's getting increasingly frustrated by that. That's creating friction. So in immigration is one example of that process and that phenomenon the caller just identified.
Our caller in Charlotte, Jack, talking about the president keeping the pot boiling as part of his M.O.
Oh, yes. And it's the essential M.O. because he's able in these instances to he keeps his frustration growing. He keeps us frustrated, the policy world frustrated, and then he also expresses his own frustration. And in doing that, he makes his essential bond, I think, with a segment of his voters, which is we are frustrated. We have had it. We are angry. We are resentful. And he is the voice of that. So even when he seems to be failing in policy terms, or perhaps the better word would be flailing, going from one extreme to another, so long as he's speaking in the tones of grievance and resentment, he's channeling something out there. A recent study found that a nearing a third of white Americans are, quote, socially intolerant. In the 1950s, it was 12%. That's the Trump base. And this base is not only socially intolerant, that is, of minority groups and of the changing culture. They are increasingly restless with democracy. They don't. They're much more willing to think of a strong leader, or even a military leader, rather than a democratic system, because that would be a way to enact their social resentment in policy. This is a very frightening phenomenon. Tom Edsel in the New York Times this week ran several of these papers, academic papers, bringing this out. And that's the danger. There is an audience in America for authoritarianism.
There is a pretty consistent set of numbers across polling organizations showing large numbers of people sort of bailing out on this deliberative, distributed powers, checks and balances system. House Speaker Paul Ryan pushed back Tuesday against questions he would leave his leadership position before his planned retirement in 8 months.
Look, obviously I serve at the pleasure of the members. Those are the people who drafted me in this job in the first place. But I think we all agree the best thing for us is to complete our agenda and not wedge into the middle of the completion of our agenda divisive leadership elections.
Now, Speaker Ryan was in a tough spot. He had to make it clear that he was leaving in order for there to be a primary process in the first district in Wisconsin, in order for the Republicans to choose a candidate for his seat. But once you signal that you're on your way out with this many months to go before the elections, it's a long walk for a speaker who already begins leeching power the moment he makes it clear he's on the way out the door. Major, Paul Ryan going to make it all the way to November as Speaker?
Well, the point he made about he serves at the pleasure of the members is a powerful truth and one he has to reconcile himself to every day, but with more difficulty each and every day, because House Republicans are very restive. They're very nervous about the prospects in the midterm election. Paul Ryan was their best and most capable and most energetic fundraiser. That ability to fundraise on behalf of members specifically in the party generally has been greatly diminished. The agenda, such as it is grinding to a halt. There's now this uprising within Republican ranks and Democratic ranks about immigration and what Paul Ryan will or will not allow on the House floor. That's becoming a proxy battle in his own future as Speaker. And if there were a compelling alternative among House Republicans to take a run at the Speaker, I think there would be a race. But there isn't, so he's safe for now. But that doesn't mean beneath his feet is not a lot of disappointment and a sense of, well, you announced really early. Yes, there were some practical reasons, but you've left us rudderless and leaderless. And without that fundraising mechanism, that makes our job of holding the majority, which is already very fragile, or keeping as many of us here in the minority as possible, all the more difficult.
Avon, Connecticut is next. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you today?
Okay.
Listen, you know, I listen to all your guests here, and I'm perplexed because it seems like they're putting all Trump voters into the same boat and making a generalization to how we all think. I don't agree with a lot of the things that were said on the show because I think there's an opposite and equal point to each and every one of them. I seem like people twist things the way they want it, and you all are agreeing to certain points, but let's just go right back to President Trump saying he was taped in his Trump towers. Well, he was taped under the FISA. He was taped by the FBI in his towers. So he was correct. It might not be wiretapping, but he was taped. They were investigating him. They had a warrant to do it, but he was right. And then they turn around and say, oh, he wasn't right in that? Well, that was correct. He was right on that. So let's go to immigration. People that are here illegally are taking away from the people that are here legally and that are Americans. If you're here illegally, you're more apt to commit crime so you can stay here. It doesn't make any sense for illegal aliens to be getting free college, free university, free homes, free food, free everything. When people here illegally and citizens are struggling every day from paycheck to paycheck just to pay the bills. We have to take responsibility for our own citizens in this country before we can go and save the world. I think that's all Mr. Trump is trying to say.
Roger, I hear the frustration in your voice, and I understand why some of these things would perplex you. But as a fellow American citizen, when I listen to you talk about, for instance, all the free things that that illegal immigrants get, the crimes they commit in order to stay. Well, yeah, the crime they commit is being here and continuing to work. But as an administrative infraction, that's one thing. But the president of the United States keeps talking about them as murderers, rapists, the people filling up the jails after violent crimes. They pay – they're said not to pay taxes. They pay an enormous amount of taxes. And they also cannot take advantage, and that's certainly justified – but they can't take advantage of the things that many of their taxes pay for, like disability insurance or unemployment insurance when they are out of work. I mean, that's almost a separate show in itself. Roger, thanks a lot for your call. And Major, when we come back, Michelle, when we come back, Jack, when we come back, let's talk about Roger's call from Avon, Connecticut. We're discussing the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Where do you stand on the new NFL policy banning kneeling during the national anthem? How will you remember Philip Roth? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. In other news this week, Congress grilled Olympic officials over sexual abuse scandals Wednesday. Representative Buddy Carter had tough questions for USA Gymnastics head Kerry Perry.
Did you do background checks on him? This sexual predator who is in jail, in prison for 30 years, did you do background checks on
him? I was not there. I can't answer that.
Well, find out who was there because I need an answer
yes,
to
sir.
It, okay?
Yes, sir.
Novelist Philip Roth died Tuesday. His exploration of sexuality and Jewish identity won him two National Book Awards and a Pulitzer.
I was very curious as a writer as to how far I could go. What happens if you go further? It's best, certainly in the early stages of a book, to abandon self-censorship.
And President Trump pardoned boxer Jack Johnson for a 1913 Jim Crow law violation. Johnson was the first black heavyweight champion.
To most of the spectators, the fight is already a foregone conclusion. In a devastating flurry, Jack Johnson shows that he can handle champion Tommy Burns like a small child.
You're welcome to join the conversation. Are you satisfied by government officials and local leaders' responses to the school shooting in Santa Fe, Texas? What is your response to the changes in the NFL rules in anticipation of the coming 18-19 pro football season? Michelle Kosinski, before we move on, I want to go back to our caller from Avon, Connecticut. His frustrations, yes, at the number of illegal residents in the country, at the fact that President Trump is maligned when he's on to something, in Roger's view. He suspected that he was being surveilled during his campaign. It doesn't turn out to be exactly what the president said, but it turns out to be close enough.
Yeah, there was a lot in there. And I think what many people, not just Democrats, not just Republicans, have a problem with is the fundamentally dishonest way that President Trump will present something as a fact. Well, as a journalist, facts matter to me. Facts matter a lot. And when the leader of a country, you know, the leader of the United States is repeatedly, constantly, I think daily, fast and loose with facts. It's tough to stomach that. And I think that I agree with a caller that you don't want to lump a group of voters into one basket. But when you look at polling numbers and when you look at the fact that among Trump supporters, it doesn't seem to matter some of these lies that he tells or some of these situations that arise among people in his, you know, that were part of the campaign or whatever it is, when it doesn't move the needle or doesn't seem to have any effect, I think that's what people often talk about when they generalize Trump voters. And on immigration, the same way, it's the presentation of the problem that I think draws a lot of division and a lot of emotion towards the issue when Trump and his administration speak about it. Because certainly most of the people who are in this country illegally are not criminals. And they pay taxes. They contribute to the American economy. And when you factor that out of it, it becomes, you know, a one-sided, just an issue that is not based entirely in fact.
Jack Beatty, part of the frustration, I think, is that when reporters push back on factual inaccuracies, it sounds pedantic. And we don't give current events exams to people before they vote or before they make up their minds about an issue. So people have passionate and firmly held beliefs about things that may not conform exactly to the way they are, but they still form the underpinning of why they believe what they believe about the state of the country.
Yes, and it's why Mr. Trump, I think, strikes a chord. I mean, he's found a way, with that phrase, fake news, to tell people that if you don't like, if you experience cognitive dissonance listening to the news, it's because it's fake. It's made up. Reach equilibrium by listening to me. Now, that may seem childish or infantile, a demand, listen to me. And yet, that seems to be the case. People listen to him on Twitter and his remarks, and he connects at some level. The rawness of his expressions of xenophobia, racism, whatever, prejudice, whatever you want to say, the rawness of those that expression is taken as is seen as authenticity, and it's taken as a proxy for truth. He's telling us the real truth because he's saying things no one else dares to say. I think there's something in that. That he's connecting with people.
Here's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell Wednesday announcing a ban on players kneeling on the football field during the national anthem.
We want people to be respectful of the national anthem. We want people to stand and make sure that they treat this moment in a respectful fashion.
Miami, Florida is our next stop. William, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. This is just an opinion from a business mind. If I hire someone to cut my grass, I don't expect them to go protest. I expect them on my time, me paying them, to do their job. Their job is simple, cut the grass. The same philosophy could be applied to the NFL and the players kneeling. Do their job. You didn't get paid. You're not getting paid to protest. You're getting paid to play the ball.
But would you concede, William, that what we expect, performance out of players on the field, is something different from cutting the grass?
I agree with you 100%. However, it all breaks down to what are you getting paid for?
No, I understand your point entirely. Major Garrett, are you much of a football fan? Do you think that we're even close to the end of this argument?
Well, we're not close to the end of the argument, but I take the caller's point, and I've heard it expressed to me in many conversations I've had with friends and as I've traveled around the country with President Trump. The essence of it for them is very simple. The football game is there for my pleasure as a ticket-purchasing fan. The owners own the field. The networks are there. It is a workplace. And workplaces are not protest places. They can be if there's labor strife, but this isn't a labor strife issue. It hasn't been. There's disconnect between the Players Association and the owners, but it's not a labor strife issue. It's not a collective bargaining issue. So in that sense, in that strict sense alone, I understand the sentiment. And clearly the president has defined this, again, conflating something that is about many different issues. The fairness of the treatment of Colin Kaepernick or the unfairness of that NFL quarterback that was, police brutality, other racial issues, many aspects of this, conflating it into do you love the country, do you respect the flag, do you respect the anthem? Well, many NFL players would say yes, and protesting about these underlying issues is utterly consistent with love of country and love of flag and love of anthem. But the president has tried to separate the two, and the NFL owners, looking at the bottom line, have more or less sided with the president's orientation to that. But I understand the caller's sentiments. I've heard it expressed many times. If you want to protest, do it after the game or on Wednesday or some other place, not when you're at your place of work. And yet the players know that the very visibility of the NFL gives them a forum there that is utterly unique and not findable on Wednesday. They can find it on a Sunday. And that's when they've chosen to take this particular action to have a larger conversation. Well, that conversation is getting farther and farther away from the players, at least as they would like to have it.
On Facebook, our listener Steve writes, NFL games aren't civic events. It's a private, for-profit enterprise. Entertainment. Why is the national anthem even part of it? Should we all stand and sing it before a movie starts at the Cineplex or before a rock concert? Boston, Massachusetts is next. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. This is actually Judith in Boston.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome, Judith.
Thank you. I concur with everything so far in terms of I think the national anthem shouldn't be played, first of all. And if it is played, then those players have an absolute right, given their First Amendment rights, given that they're Americans, they have a right to do what they think is in their interest. And I think it speaks to the culture that we're in right now, that this is even being questioned, that First Amendment rights are being questioned.
Just as the players have a right to protest, does the president, Judith, have a right to weigh in and speak to this as a cultural issue?
Sure, he does. But the fact that his opinion and his weight on this ends up with these players having to stay in the locker room if they want to kneel is just unconscionable. It's outrageous. It's scaring me that we're moving towards an authoritarian state. Like one of your guests just said, if the national anthem needs to be played at all, then should we be playing it in movie theaters? And if we need to do it in every place, then people have a right to say they hate what their country is about right now or that they love what their country is about right now. That's a right.
Judith, calling from Boston, Massachusetts. On Friday, Harvey Weinstein turned himself in. He's been arraigned on rape, criminal sex act, and other sex charges stemming from encounters with two women. He agreed to post $1 million cash bail, wear an electronic monitor, and not travel beyond New York and Connecticut. Weinstein didn't enter a plea. That's common at this stage in a criminal case in New York. Weinstein's lawyer says he believes the movie mogul will ultimately be exonerated of rape and other sex charges against him in New York. Attorney Benjamin Braffman says Weinstein vehemently denies the charges. Edgecombe, Maine is next. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Christopher, what's up?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm away from the radio now, so I'm lost which topic we're on now.
Christopher, we cannot leave. Once you enter into this implied contract with On Point, Christopher, you got to stay by the radio. That's part of the deal we make with each other, even though we can't look each other in the face. I just was talking about Harvey Weinstein.
It's quite simple. I mean, it's been proven. I personally believe there's overwhelming evidence. I think he should have been jailed long before now, and it's a great thing that he's finally turned himself in, which I don't think he had much choice. But, you know, he'll get what's coming to him, hopefully.
You know, Michelle Kaczynski, Me Too shows in some ways no sign of abating. People who perhaps covered up, perhaps were reluctant to talk about experiences in their own past, their own victimization. It's like an alarm bell goes off when you finally say, now I can talk about this. And the longer we have this conversation, the more people are willing to come forward about their encounters with more different people.
Right. You wonder how many people out there that you know are now deeply afraid that things that either they thought were acceptable or the people around them seemed to think were acceptable are not acceptable. And now everybody is putting it out there, which I think is a healthy thing, especially for people who felt deeply victimized by, you know, even far less than what Harvey Weinstein is accused of doing, you know, victimized and hurt and felt like their career was affected, if not ruined, by such things. So for that to get out there, it's like this emotional purging. On the other hand, it's a very complicated issue that has now brought up victim blaming and how much complicity might some of the victims had in there, as well as I think the excuse or the explanation that you're hearing more and more from some of the men who've been accused is, well, you know, I never meant to make anyone feel uncomfortable. If I have, I'm sorry, but I just didn't know. So there are these gray areas that come up, too, of like, you know, how much does the intent factor in if no one was harmed? You know, I think this is an ongoing discussion that gets more and more complicated. And you're right. It's not going anywhere.
Is there a conversation that people like me are not hearing among and between women?
Ah, that's a good question. I feel like the conversation that goes on, especially among women who, you know, it's hard because I think if you have been victimized in any way by this kind of behavior, you feel differently than those who have not experienced it. Just like with any kind of crime or any kind of experience, you don't really know how it feels until it happens to you. And then the complexity of human emotion gets in the way of, like, you know, it's not a black and white thing. So I think there's a conversation among women for some of the cases when you hear the details. And I feel like I've felt this too, that you feel like, well, okay, it was a hard, it's in no way the victim's fault. The guy should never have done that. It's disgusting in many cases. But why did the woman let it get to that point? Why did you go up to that room? Or you shouldn't have done that. And I think that goes without saying, but there is complexity there. And when I've had those conversations with other women, or when I've thought those thoughts or had those questions, I felt like my mind was kind of changed when I then read a full account of what exactly happened. And then you can understand more how it got to that point. So I think it would help people get it if they read more of the detailed accounts that some of these women have, you know, of what they've experienced.
Well, I mismanaged my time, Jack, but I did want you to give you a chance before we close for today to say a few words about Philip Roth.
Oh, well, like millions of people, I greatly admired his work and the strength of his writing. And you quoted, we quoted him earlier talking about, you know, risking and willing to go out on the limb and finding his freedom in saying things. And that really, I think, is the effect he had on readers as well, that you felt a little freer after you listened to him, freer about your own nature, good and bad, and freer about the range of things you could express.
Jack Beatty, have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. Terrific to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Michelle Kosinski, CNN Senior Diplomatic Correspondent covering the State Department. Great to talk to you as well.
Such a pleasure. Thanks.
Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And join us next week. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.